طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the mainstream media's news and analysis. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we have again witnessed U.S. politicians, including former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, falling over Israel at the annual meeting of its powerful U.S. lobbying arm, AIPAC. Many other so-called liberals joined him on the podium. Representative Steny Hoyer, Senators Chris Coons, Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker, and Robert Menendez, to name just a few. They continue to have no qualms supporting a blatantly apartheid Jim Crow Israel, and yet they talk one game while discussing civil liberty and human rights in the U.S., but do not apply the same standards to Israel. In fact, it is so with almost the entire Congress. Double standards, hypocrisy. To illustrate this, I want to begin this week reading an article written by Jonathan Cook, a British journalist who, for many years, has lived and written from Nazareth and is a strong voice in exposing the vicious underbelly of Israeli society. He exposes what our Congress supports with impunity. This week, Jonathan Cook wrote, and I quote, "It has been a very bad week for those claiming Israel has the most moral army in the world. Here is a small sample of abuses of Palestinians in recent days in which the Israeli army was caught lying. A child horrifically injured by soldiers was arrested and terrified into signing a false confession that he was hurt in a bicycle accident. A man who, it was claimed, had died of tear gas inhalation was actually shot at point-blank range, then savagely beaten by a mob of soldiers and left to die. And soldiers threw a tear gas canister at a Palestinian couple, baby in arms, as they fled for safety during a military invasion of their village. In the early 2000s, at the dawn of the social media revolution, Israelis used to dismiss filmed evidence of brutality by their soldiers as fakery. It was what they called Pallywood, a conflation of Palestine and Hollywood. In truth, however, it was the Israeli military, not the Palestinians, that needed to manufacture a more convenient version of reality. Last week it emerged, Israel officials had conceded to a military court that the army had beaten and locked up a group of Palestinian reporters as part of an explicit policy of stopping journalists from covering abuses by its soldiers. Israel's deceptions have a long history. Back in the 1970s, a young Giuliano Meir Kamis, later to become one of Israel's most celebrated actors, was assigned the job of carrying a weapons bag on operations in the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank. When Palestinian women or children were killed, he placed a weapon next to the body. In one incident, when soldiers playing around with a shoulder launcher fired a missile at a donkey and the 12-year girl riding it, Meir Kamis was ordered to put explosives on their remains. That occurred before the Palestinians' first mass uprising against the occupation, which erupted in late 1980s. Then the defense minister, Yitzhak Rabin, later given a Hollywood-style makeover himself as a peacemaker, urged troops to break the bones of Palestinians to stop their liberation struggle. The desperate and sometimes self-sabotaging lengths Israel takes to try to salvage its image were underscored last week when a 15-year-old, Mohammed Tamimi, was grabbed from his bed in a night raid. Back in December, he was shot in the face by soldiers during an invasion of his village of Nabi Saleh. Doctors saved his life, but he was left with a misshapen head and a section of his skull missing. Mohammed's suffering made headlines because he was a bit player in a larger drama. Shortly after he was shot, a video recorded his cousin, 16-year-old Ahed Tamimi, slapping a soldier nearby after he entered her home. Ahed, who was in jail awaiting trial, was already a Palestinian resistance icon. Now she has become a symbol, too, of Israel's victimization of children. So Israel began work on recrafting the narrative of Ahad as a terrorist and provocateur. It emerged that a government minister, Michael Oren, had even set up a secret committee to try to prove that Ahad and her family were really paid actors, not Palestinians, there to make Israel look bad. The Pallywood delusion had gone into overdrive. Last week, events took a new turn as Mohammed and other relatives were seized, and even though he is still gravely ill, dragged off to an interrogation cell where he was denied access to a lawyer or parent. Shortly afterwards, Israel produced a signed confession stating that Mohammed's horrific injuries were not Israel's responsibility, but wounds inflicted in a bicycle crash. Yoav Mordechai, the occupation's top official, trumpeted proof of a Palestinian culture of lies and incitement. Mohammed's injuries were fake news, the Israeli media dutifully reported. Deprived of a justification for slapping an occupation soldier, Ahed can now be locked away by military judges, except that witnesses' phone records and hospital documentation, including brain scans, all prove that Mohammed was shot. This was simply another of Israeliwood's endless productions to automatically confer guilt on Palestinians. The hundreds of children on Israel's incarceration production line each year have to sign confessions or plea bargains to win jail sentence reductions from courts with near 100% conviction rates. It is more Franz Kafka than Hollywood. A second army narrative unraveled last week. CCTV showed Yassin Saradi, 35, being shot at point-blank range during the invasion of Jericho, then savagely beaten by soldiers as he lay wounded and left to bleed to death. It was an unexceptional incident. A report by Amnesty International last month noted that many of the dozens of Palestinians killed in 2017 appeared to be victims of extrajudicial executions. Before footage of Saradi's killing surfaced, the army issued a series of false statements, including that he died from tear gas inhalation, received first aid treatment, and was armed with a knife. The video disproves all of that. Over the past 2 years, dozens of Palestinians, including women and children, have been shot in similar suspicious circumstances, Invariably, the army concludes that they were killed while attacking soldiers with a knife. Israel even named this period of unrest the Knife Intifada. Are soldiers today carrying a knife bag, just as mere commies once carried a weapons bag? A half century of occupation has not only corrupted generations of teenage Israeli soldiers who have been allowed to lord over Palestinians, it has also needed an industry of lies and deceptions to make sure the consciences of Israelis are never clouded by a moment of doubt that maybe their army is not so moral after all. Unquote. That was an article written by journalist Jonathan Cook, exposing the daily atrocities perpetrated by Israel against the occupied Palestinian people, defended so vociferously by our occupied Congress. Okay, on to our feature presentation. This morning we feature an in-depth historical analysis of many of Israel's laws and policies which define the legal structure for their discriminatory apartheid state. Boston University Law School professor Susan Ockram lays it all out in a presentation she gave at Harvard's JFK School of Government. Professor Susan Ockram directs BU Law's International Human Rights Clinic, in which she supervises students engaged in international advocacy in domestic, international, regional, and UN fora. She is a recognized expert on refugee law and as such teaches and lectures throughout the world. Here is Professor Susan Ockram speaking at JFK's School of Government.
Good evening, and thank you for spending your evening this way, talking about a very discouraging subject. And for those of you going on the delegation, I wish I were going with you. But I congratulate you on the decision to be taking what is going to be an amazing trip for you. So what I'd like to do tonight is to focus on some of the core contested issues in the Israel-Palestine conflict. And that is the question of nationality, self-determination, and the relationship of these to the refugee question. These are at the core of this very long conflict, protracted conflict. I want to discuss the question of nationality with regard to Palestinians, the claim of Jewish nationality, compare Palestinian nationality with the claim of Jewish nationality, and fourth, self-determination rights in the context of both people's territorial claims based on return. And in the time I have left, I was asked to touch a little bit on the law that applies to the Israeli occupation and the settlement project and the International Court of Justice opinion on the construction of Israel's wall. So I'll try to do that in about 20 minutes. Take a deep breath. So starting off with Palestinian nationality, the argument that Palestinians have a recognized nationality begins with the Ottoman Empire. Palestine was a part of the Ottoman Empire from 1516 until 1923. Various changes occurred to the territory, none of which are really important to our nationality question, until the Treaty of Lausanne on 24 July 1923. On 6th August of 1924, under the terms of the Lausanne Treaty, Ottoman citizens who resided in the territory of Palestine became Palestinian citizens. As a matter of international law, Palestinian nationality was formed on this date. The Lausanne Treaty also created separate borders, separate territories, fixed borders, and established separate nationalities for Transjordan, Egypt, Syria, and Lebanon. Following the Lausanne Treaty, each of these territories, including Palestine, had a citizenship law that codified their nationality status. Under the British mandate during the League of Nations period from 1922 until 1948, Palestinian citizenship was codified by British law, the Palestinian Citizenship Order of 1925, which included the acquisition of Palestinian citizenship through birth in Palestine. The Palestinian citizenship order afforded Palestinian citizenship to all those who were Turkish subjects or citizens at the time of the Lausanne Treaty and those who were habitual residents in Palestine. The population meeting this criteria numbered 847,000 people. These included, however, certain foreign residents who had immigrated to Palestine between 1920 and 1922, mostly immigrant Jews. Approximately 38,000 people were granted Palestine citizenship under a proclamation passed by the British government that any person other than those of Ottoman nationality, habitually resident in Palestine on that date, could also apply for Palestinian citizenship. So far, aside from the complication of the British mandate itself and the inclusion of the terms of the Balfour Declaration, which I will come to later, the recognition and codification of Palestinian nationality was consistent with international law. It attached to a population that was genuinely and intrinsically linked to a defined territory. It was also consistent with the customary law rule that inhabitants found on a territory, when there's a change of sovereignty, should automatically acquire the nationality of the successor state. The British citizenship law, even granting status to immigrants, was generally consistent with these rules. Under the British citizenship law, Palestinians could obtain passports, and over 70,000 Palestinian passports were issued during this period. The next major legal historical development relevant to the question of Palestinian nationality was the passage of Resolution 181, the Partition Plan, on 29 November of 1947. First of all, it's important to note that Resolution 181 was a General Assembly resolution, not a Security Council resolution. And under the United Nations Charter, the General Assembly has no authority to divide territory or to enforce any kind of obligation on states or peoples. The United Nations recognized this itself, as after passage of 181, both the Security Council and Britain, the mandatory power, refused to enforce the partition plan. The UN Secretariat issued an interpretation stating that Resolution 181, and I quote, has no obligatory character whatsoever. The attempt to take the issue of the legality of Resolution 181 to the International Court for an advisory opinion was narrowly defeated by states strong-armed by the United States and Israel to defeat the effort. Second, it's important to understand the actual provisions of Resolution 181. In terms of the question of nationalities, it is true that the British had separated Jewish from Arab nationalities in Palestine in incorporating the Balfour Declaration into the mandate and in granting citizenship to Jews who had entered and remained illegally. Still, the Jews given citizenship were those actually residing in Palestine, not outside. Resolution 181's recognition of a Jewish and an Arab state did refer to religious and racial criteria to identify territorial division, but referred to them as the two peoples of Palestine. The plan stated that Palestinian citizens residing in Palestine, as well as Arabs and Jews who, not holding Palestinian citizenship, but residing in Palestine, shall, upon the recognition of independence, become citizens of the state in which they are resident and enjoy full civil and political rights. This requires careful note. The plan's principle was that Palestinian citizens, regardless of their religion, residing in the Arab state, would become citizens of that Arab state. Palestinian citizens residing in the Jewish state, regardless of their religion, would become citizens of the Jewish state. Moreover, the population demographics on which the partition plan was based were incorrect because they excluded the Arab Bedouins. Even so, not taking the Bedouins into account, the plan proposed a Jewish state, and I say Jewish in quotes, because again, the plan refers to the two Palestinian peoples, with 498,000 Jews and 497,000 Palestinians. In the proposed Palestinian state, there would be 725,000 Palestinians and 10,000 Jews. a bare majority even in the Jewish state. Finally, the resolution required a one-year period prior to recognition of independence of either state, during which time both states had to incorporate constitutions that provided for equal rights for all citizens with no discrimination. Thus, the partition plan did not authorize either state to institutionalize superior rights for any religious or racial group. Aside from recommending partition of territory that was not within its authority, the General Assembly's plan of how division was to be made, that is, on the basis of the habitual residents and citizens already on each territory, was on its terms consistent with international law. It preserved Palestinian nationality stemming from the Lausanne Treaty and the British citizenship laws of Palestine. Nothing in Resolution 181 gives support for a claim of Jewish nationality other than those Jews habitually resident in Palestine, eligible for Palestinian citizenship, living in their territory. The next important document is Resolution 194, and I want to talk briefly about its effect on the nationality question. Resolution 194, which was passed hard on the heels of the exodus of the Palestinian refugees, makes a reference to refugees that also relates directly to the United Nations' view of Palestinian citizenship or nationality. In passing Resolution 194 on 11th December of 1948, the General Assembly established a specialized agency, the United Nations Conciliation Commission for Palestine, with a very broad mandate to resolve both the conflict and the massive refugee problem. It also defined the refugees for whom the UNCCP would provide international protection. And in a particular paragraph, paragraph 11, it set out a legal formula for resolving the refugee problem. Although there's no clear definition of Palestinian refugee incorporated in the language of Resolution 194, the drafting history and subsequent UN Secretariat interpretations clarify exactly what people were defined by that term. The resolution of 11 December 1948, the UNCCP's authoritative analysis of the General Assembly resolution, states that the term refugees applies to all persons, Arabs, Jews, and others, who have been displaced from their homes in Palestine. The legal advisor note to the UNCCP that was issued on 9 April 1951 defined further the categories of Palestinian refugees covered by the terms of Resolution 194 and the mandate of the agency, the UNCCP. These were, not surprisingly, all habitual residents and citizens of Palestine defined as such, as well as their descendants, tracing back to the Lausanne Treaty. Today, such persons would number approximately 11 million Palestinians worldwide. The next and final set of documents that relate to our question of nationality are the Israeli nationality and citizenship laws. Now, Israel's declaration of its state in May of 1948 claimed that the State of Israel would guarantee equal rights for all its citizens without discrimination. However, shortly afterwards, Israel passed a series of laws that not only affected the rights and interests of Palestinians to their properties, but also permanently affected their legal connection to their homeland. Concerning the status of who would be citizens of the new state, Israel passed two separate laws on nationality citizenship. The first, the 1950 Law of Return, which most of you have heard about, gives every Jew in the world the right to immigrate to Israel and become Jewish nationals of Israel. The second, the 1952 Nationality Citizenship Law, gives four methods for obtaining Israeli nationality: return, which under the 1950 law is for Jews only, residence in Israel, birth, or naturalization. But the law did something else. It retroactively repealed Palestinian citizenship under the Palestinian Citizenship Orders of 1925, which we've already talked about, to the date that Israel was declared a state Under this law, all Palestinians who could not meet the requirements for obtaining Israeli nationality became stateless as a matter of Israeli law, a conclusion affirmed by the majority of decisions of the Israeli courts. Not surprisingly, because that was in fact the intention, none of the 750,000 Palestinian refugees nor their children were able to satisfy the conditions set down by the law. So is there a Jewish nationality? What is little understood about the Israeli nationality law is that it creates a legal fiction. There's no such thing as Israeli nationality, as the Israeli High Court itself has confirmed. Israeli law, official institutions or records do not recognize an Israeli nationality status. Israel's Interior Ministry lists over 100 nationalities. No Israeli nationality is listed. The only nationality to which superior rights and privileges are attached is Jewish nationality. Jewish nationality is restricted to those qualifying under the 1950 Law of Return and its specific amendments, or Jews immigrating into Israel. Now, these two laws set up a two-tiered system, one for Jews who are nationals of Israel and can automatically become citizens, a second for non-Jews who can become citizens but can never become nationals of Israel. Superior rights, including rights to the majority of land in Israel, are reserved exclusively for Jews by virtue of the system. In terms of its impact on international nationality law as an aspect of the right of return, it's crucial to understand that this violates customary rules of nationality that have become increasingly well settled as a matter of treaty law since 1948, and I'll talk a little bit more about this. As an international legal matter, Israel could not define as its nationals persons who are nationals of other states with no connection to the territory, particularly if doing so did not require the specific consent of the individual foreign nationals and their states. In 1955, the International Court of Justice determined that from the perspective of international law, a state's granting of nationality must be based on some close connection between the state and the individual, and that decisions on nationality are not solely within the purview of states. In this case, the 1955 case called Nottebohm, the International Court of Justice found that nationality is a legal bond having as its basis a social fact of attachment, a genuine connection of existence, interests, and sentiments together with the existence of reciprocal rights and duties. In other words, a state cannot simply confer its nationality on persons of foreign nationality living in other states absent a close connection between the person and that state, even if the person accepts that status. By 1955, then, the question of who is a national was no longer within the sole discretion of states and their domestic law, and the status of nationality could be denied international recognition if the requisite factors constituting a genuine link were missing. Jewish claims of nationality and self-determination, then, have to be clearly distinguished from the claims of Israeli Jews to nationality and self-determination as a matter of international law. Israel proclaimed her state on behalf of the Jewish people, a concept and definition that grants rights to and within a state on an extraterritorial basis. Israel enacted its citizenship law in 1950 to grant nationality to Jews only, repealing the Palestinian citizenship law. The people entitled to national status, however, in the Jewish state defined under the partition resolution 181 included both Jews and Palestinians, but only those residing in the territory or Palestinians who could connect their national status to the Lausanne Treaty. Both of these groups were to be granted equal rights, as I said, under a constitution that was supposed to be in force in both new states prior to the UN recognition of either. The UN, including its treaty bodies and the International Court of Justice, has repeatedly called this Jewish preferencing under Israeli citizenship, property, and other laws a violation of the UN Charter and human rights treaties. In other words, there's been no recognition of the Jewish people as a nationality concept that grants self-determination rights. Nor is there legal consensus that Israel has a right to maintain a legal preferencing system that grants superior rights to Jews as against other citizens of the Israeli state. Now let me touch briefly on the issues of refugees and the right of return, which flow from this nationality analysis. The Israeli law repealing the Palestine citizenship law and replacing it with one that denationalized the vast majority of Palestinians in 1950, then, from the point of view of international law, was an illegal act. That is so because it violated two fundamental customary law principles: that all habitual residents of the territory of a state which succeeds another must be granted citizenship in the new state, and that no state can arbitrarily denationalize habitual residents of its state on the basis of protected grounds such as race, religion, ethnic, or national origin. If Palestinian nationality remained intact from 1924 because Israel's denationalization was void from an international law perspective, then all Palestinians recognized under that nationality law and their descendants have the right to claim nationality tied to the territory covered by British mandate dating back to the time of such recognition. So what is the status of Palestinian nationality today, and what relevance does that have to the demand for Palestinian right of return? On the one hand, there's an argument that Palestinians continue to retain Palestinian nationality to the present. This is based on the historical and legal facts that I described. And that Israel's revocation of Palestinian citizenship and denationalization of Palestinians was illegal, and its denial then of Palestinian return is also illegal. This argument rests on the claim that Israel's acts, being illegal, do not affect Palestinian nationality as a matter of international law today. And that nationality is unbroken despite the inability of the majority of Palestinians to return to their homes. It is my contention that Palestinians have been right in maintaining that their Palestinian nationality remains intact today, that they are not stateless, and that their right of return is based squarely on their rights as nationals of Palestine, not solely as refugees. Moreover, there's no parallel legal authority for a claim of Jewish nationality that negates Palestine national rights. Let me address a little bit more of the law relating to refugees. The right of return for refugees and displaced persons has its authority in at least three distinct bodies of law: international humanitarian law, the law of nationality and state succession, which we've been talking about, and human rights law, which includes law governing the status and treatment of refugees. The rights in these bodies of law are derived both from specific treaties and customary international law. That is, the rights have not only been codified in some of the most widely ratified or accepted treaties by states, including treaties that Israel itself has ratified, but also have become state practice through incorporation in post-conflict settlement agreements and peace agreements in the context of mass refugee flows all around the world. I can only briefly touch on these, starting with the first, the humanitarian law rules that govern repatriation of civilians in times of conflict. These rules arise under the Fourth Geneva Convention, but were also incorporated in earlier treaties going back to the 1907 Hague Convention and regulations from World War I onwards. In the Fourth Geneva Convention, we find a very interesting article, Article 49, which provides that evacuated persons must be transferred back to their homes as soon as hostilities have ceased. A series of other articles complement the obligation to release civilians and allow them to return home or to facilitate their repatriation at the end of conflict. In the second body of law, that of nationality and state succession, we find several interrelated principles. One of the most important for Palestinians is the obligation that we've talked about on a successor state to grant nationality to all original inhabitants of the territory. This is related both to nationality obligations, which prohibit a state from taking action that would arbitrarily denationalize former nationals, but also to the obligation not to create stateless persons or a population of stateless persons on discriminatory grounds. And related to that, not to force a population of refugees onto another state's territory. That raises diplomatic considerations. A successor state cannot arbitrarily define nationals, cannot arbitrarily define the new citizens or nationals of its state on a discriminatory basis. And one very important formulation of this rule appears in the International Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which specifically prohibits states from discriminating and requires them to guarantee the right of everyone to return to their own country and not to be denied the right to return on discriminatory grounds. Israel is a party to the CERD. One of the most important and most contested sources of the right of return is a particular article in the International Convention of Civil and Political Rights, and which expands on an earlier provision in the Universal Declaration, which basically says that everyone shall be free to leave any country, including his own, and no one shall be arbitrarily deprived of the right to enter his own country. If Palestinians are nationals of historic Palestine, that is their country. As you can imagine, each phrase of this provision has been contested when it comes to Palestinians, and Israeli arguments challenging this that this provision does not apply to Palestinian refugees include that Israel has not arbitrarily denied Palestinians the right to return. It denies them on security grounds. Palestinians are not nationals of Israel, and so they're not being denied the right to return to their own country. That Israel is entitled to suspend this and other rights in terms of extreme emergency, and Israel has declared a state of emergency since the inception of its state for the last over 60 years, and that in any case, this provision does not apply to mass returns and so would not require the return of millions of Palestinian refugees. I can just touch on a couple of these arguments briefly because we don't have time to cover them all, but I'm happy to engage on any of them in Q&A. First of all, the drafting history and customary law underlying this provision makes it clear that the phrase "own country" was deliberately chosen to refer to a much broader concept of territory than just to people defined as citizens or nationals under domestic law. In reviewing the meaning of this phrase, the UN Human Rights Committee, which is the body responsible for interpreting this particular treaty, issued an interpretation in 1999 saying that the scope of his own country is broader than the concept of country of nationality. What this interpretation refers to is the main decision on nationality that I mentioned, the Nottebohm case of 1955, which discussed those special links to a given territory that determine a person's habitual residence or effective national ties to it. Moreover, there's nothing in the drafting history or application of the principle in other refugee cases around the world that suggests that it is limited to individual rather than mass refugee returns. Finally, the last area of law on right of return is the subset of human rights law, the law on refugees. The main treaty on the status of refugees is the 1951 Refugee Convention, or its companion protocol. The implementation of this convention rests in the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. And I can't go into the bifurcated mandate under which Palestinians were given a separate mandate through the establishment of UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency. We can also talk about that separately. But basically, the UNHCR is the refugee agency for all of the world's refugees except for Palestinians, but because it has such a huge mandate, it basically establishes the law vis-a-vis refugees and interprets the main treaties. And just a few principles reiterated by UNHCR are important here, both to Palestinians and to all other refugees. First of all is the principle of a refugee's absolute right to return on a voluntary basis to their place of origin, including to their original homes. of the three durable solutions available, voluntary repatriation, voluntary host country integration, or voluntary resettlement, the UNHCR and most states in the world consider voluntary repatriation the most appropriate solution. Now, there's a reason for that. Voluntary repatriation is the only one of the three durable solutions that represents a right, an absolute right accorded to the individual, that is, the right to go home. The other two solutions are neither rights of refugees nor obligations on receiving states, as no state has an obligation to accept a non-national into their territory. And that's a really important principle vis-a-vis the argument that the Arab host states are required to grant nationality to the Palestinians on their territory. Now, state practice also reinforces that refugee return is an entrenched customary international law norm. Return of refugees as individuals and in large groups has taken place in the context of formal repatriation agreements and explicit recognition by conflicting parties that returning refugees are doing so out of right. The agreements on refugee return for Bosnia, Croatia, Guatemala, and so many other countries around the world describe the right of refugees and displaced persons to return to their homes of origin as being unqualified. The Dayton Accord incorporates exactly the three rights that are included for Palestinians in Resolution 194: the right of return, right of property restitution, and the right of compensation. Just a quick look at the last decade of the 1990s shows that while approximately 12 million refugees returned home, just 1.3 million were resettled during that period. In every period since the coming into force of the Refugee Convention, no more than approximately 10% of the world's refugees were integrated or resettled in other states. The vast majority returned home. As I mentioned, Israel's a party to all the major treaties that ground the right of return. And Israel remains bound to the obligation to permit Palestinian refugee return despite the long passage of time and to remedy the denationalization and expulsion. And the implementing the right of return under law is the remedy for the forced expulsion. So from state and international practice alone, it's evident that under international law, refugee return is the rule, and non-recognition of Palestinian refugee right of return is an aberration. I don't think we have time to talk about the occupation and settlements. I simply want to talk about the Wall opinion for just a minute, because it's a very important decision. It is the first time that any issue relating to the Palestine-Israeli conflict made it to the International Court of Justice, and the fact that this is the first opinion in over 60 years is in itself remarkable. In July 2004, in the legal consequences of the construction of a wall in the occupied territory, the International Court of Justice ruled on seven really important points. And I'll only talk about the most important ones, which is, first of all, that in a 14-1 decision, that the construction of the Israeli wall in the occupied territory violates international law. The ICJ also concluded that the wall as currently constructed must be dismantled, that Israel must immediately stop construction, dismantle the wall, terminate its breaches of international law, and nullify all related legislation, actions, and policies. It also required that Israel must restore all Palestinian properties confiscated in construction of the wall and pay reparations for all damage caused by such construction. It also found that the community of states, and this is one of the most important aspects of this opinion, have an obligation to ensure compliance with international humanitarian law, specifically the Fourth Geneva Convention, not to recognize Israel's actions in constructing the wall and in establishing the wall regime, and to cease all aid to Israel in supporting those acts. Finally, it found that the United Nations particularly the General Assembly and the Security Council, must take further action to terminate the illegal situation resulting from the wall's construction. And I just want to talk about the point about international obligations. The
Professor Akram, if we can sort of...
Yes, I'm almost done. The ICJ concluded, besides that the ceasing of construction, that there were obligations on the international community of states, and those obligations were triggered by the findings of violation of international law, and they required non-recognition of Israel's actions, non-support of the carrying out of additional expropriation and other human rights abuses carried out against the Palestinian people. So I'll end by just saying this was rather an exhausting excursus into international law, whose relevance I think many of you will question, given the seemingly intractable nature of the conflict. But I would say that law is a necessary, even though insufficient, element for resolving a prolonged crisis of this kind. Too frequently, though, law is disregarded as either irrelevant or minimally relevant to the resolution of long-running conflicts such as this. That view, however, fails to take into account that customary international law is based on the actual practice of states. States and individual government actors respond to the pressure of civil society, and civil society is persuaded to act by a perception of injustice persuasively articulated as a violation of legal norms. The challenge for civil society is to transform the existing legal framework into diplomatic action. Success in achieving the end of this crisis depends not only on state action, but on a sustained strategy to use existing law as any other tool to realize the legitimate rights of the main victims of this conflict, the Palestinian people.
You have been listening to Boston University Professor Susan Akram speaking at the Harvard JFK School of Government. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.